Hi, Neurology Podcast family. If you're like me and feeling like there's just too much data to keep up on with coronavirus, especially as it applies to our neurology patients, just go to the main American Academy of Neurology webpage, where there's a link to a clearinghouse of neurology-related information on the coronavirus from all of the AAN and neurology publications.
Thanks for tuning in for the March 31st podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights generic glatiramer acetate's effects on lowering MS costs. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear a discussion on the association between out-of-pocket costs and adherence to common neurologic medications. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
This is Jason Crowell at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and today I'm joined again by Dan Hartung. He is a pharmacist and a researcher at Oregon State University College of Pharmacy. We were fortunate enough to have Dan join us on the January 28th podcast for an interview on the price of drugs used to treat multiple sclerosis and what is really driving drug makers' decisions of where to set prices. I encourage you to check out that podcast if you haven't listened to it already. Today, for our featured interview, we're discussing Dan and colleagues' paper published this week in the Neurology Journal titled Effect of Generic Glatiramer Acetate on Spending and Use of Drugs for Multiple Sclerosis. Dan, thank you for joining us again today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we talked about this at length a few weeks ago in our last podcast, but the price of drugs to treat MS are often held up as an example of the drug pricing problem here in the U.S. And as you point out in this paper, in just over 10 years, from 2000 to 2013, the average annual price for disease-modifying treatments increased between 4 to 5-fold and exceeds $70,000 a year for most drugs. Another fact you point out that was staggering to me, so I want to share this one as well, that in 2013, Medicare spent $820 million on glatiramer acetate alone, which is obviously just one drug used to treat patients with multiple sclerosis. And in that same year, Medicare spent $939 million in total for all clinical services provided by neurologists. And I thought that was just staggering. So in just a minute, we'll get into the specifics of what you looked at in this paper, but I wanted to start by asking you a question similar to where we left things last time we talked, which is, do you think there's anything we as clinicians should be doing differently in our practice given these skyrocketing MS drug prices?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main objective of our series of studies that we've been doing is to just bring awareness about these high prices and the high costs of these medications to neurologists so they understand that virtually all the medications that are used to treat multiple sclerosis, you know, the list prices for them oftentimes exceed $80,000 a year. And a large proportion of individuals with multiple sclerosis can face considerable barriers and financial difficulties, often due to out-of-pocket costs due to these medications and or insurance hassles that physicians and neurologists have to deal with that may delay or disrupt treatment for their patients. And so I think the work that we've been doing is mostly just trying to enhance awareness both among practicing neurologists and policymakers about these rising costs for these medications. When we've inspected the class of drugs that are used to treat multiple sclerosis, you know, one of the reasons that people have speculated that prices are increasing so rapidly or have increased so rapidly is that there's been a relative lack of competition from generics over the lifespan of the class of these drugs, which goes back 25 or 30 years until 2015 when the first generic for Copaxone was approved. And so that was really the genesis of this current paper, was to examine utilization and spending trends subsequent to the release of this new generic formulation.
I think that's very valuable that we as clinicians consider the risk of inducing financial toxicity in our patients from the medications that we prescribe. And I have to agree with you. I do think that many of us, myself included, think that the dramatic rise in prices for MS drugs is somehow related to insufficient supply of generics. But what did you actually find when you looked at the effect of generics in the market for MS drugs?
Right. So in 2015, a generic version of glatiramer was approved. It actually has a branded name called Glatopa. It's manufactured by Sandoz. And essentially what we found is that following the approval of that drug, we tracked kind of utilization of all the various glatiramer products and formulations, and then utilization of the other DMTs. And we also looked at spending per prescription. And we used publicly available Medicaid data, which is readily available data, and it's a general kind of indicator of, I would say, just population level utilization of these medications. So we looked at utilization, and we also looked at spending per prescription, which is proxy of price changes after release of this new generic. And what we found is, with respect to pricing, the one notable thing that we found is that there was almost an immediate increase in the cost per prescription for the originator Copaxone 20 milligram following the introduction of this new generic. So the price of the branded drug seemed to go up almost immediately following the release of this new generic. The prices for the other DMTs, non-glatiramer DMTs, kind of held steady and continued on their upward trajectory with really modest changes one way or the other. So it didn't really seem to affect the prices for other drugs within the class. So that's kind of what happened with respect to price. The other interesting thing that we observed, and many of your listeners will probably know this, that a year and a half prior to the release of this generic Copaxone, Teva Pharmaceuticals released a 40 milligram version of Copaxone, which is dosed 3 times a week. And over that 18-month period between the initial release of the 40 milligram Copaxone and the introduction of the generic product, about 50% of the Copaxone market share was shifted to this 40 milligram version, which is not interchangeable with the released generic product in 2015. So Teva, in a way, mitigated a lot of the effect of the release of this generic by shifting their market share to a non-interchangeable version of Copaxone, which probably had an impact in terms of lessening the impact on prices that we saw.
Yeah. So with regards to that first point about the immediate rise in the brand name Copaxone when a generic was introduced, that's just not intuitive, right? Why would more comparable drugs in the market be associated with an increase in average price? And you call this a generic paradox. Would you mind explaining that to us?
Sure. There have been some previous studies that have looked at similar situations where a new generic comes on the scene and looking at what happens to the branded price. And other studies have shown that there's been kind of increases in the branded price in the opposite direction of where the generic would go. So they seem to be even competing less in price. And I think there's a couple of theories. And so it is not intuitive. You would think that if anything, the price would moderate a little bit to at least stay comparable with the new generic. Which, by the way, that new generic for Copaxone was priced maybe about 20 or 30% below the price of Copaxone when it came on the scene. But in fact, yeah, we did observe this immediate jump in the price of branded Copaxone. The thought behind it is that in an effort to maintain revenue, perhaps Teva, knowing that they're going to be losing market share, would increase the price to kind of continue maintaining a certain amount of revenue in that they would have lost in market share. Or this is within the Medicaid population that we pulled this data. And, you know, the Medicaid program has one of the largest federally mandated rebates of any payer. So there could be some rebate games that were going on in the background. And so one of the major limitations of our paper is the fact that, you know, we don't have any information on rebates for the specific DMTs. We tried to make some adjustments based on what the average rebate for the Medicaid program was overall, but we don't have any data on specifically what was happening with specific drugs. So it's possible that there were a lot of supplemental rebates that brought the net price for Copaxone down to comparable or below what Glatopa was priced when it came out. So it's really hard to understand on a drug-to-drug basis and within specific states kind of what was going on in terms of net pricing and net expenditures on these medications. But we do see this increase in list price, which has been observed with other situations where a new generic is approved.
And Dan, with regards to the second point that you made about the drug maker introducing a 40 milligram dose about, I think you said, a year and a half prior to the introduction of the generic, that raises some questions about the timing and motivation. Would you care to comment on their introducing this alternative strength dose soon before the introduction of a generic?
Sure. This is a very common practice of pharmaceutical manufacturers that are anticipating a generic competitor being approved, and that whereby the branded manufacturer will release a slightly altered or different tweaked molecule, perhaps the prodrug or a different formulation of their kind of franchise drug in efforts to essentially continue their franchise of that particular therapy. So it's done a lot in industry as a way of kind of maintaining revenue past when a branded medication stands to lose market exclusivity. So the fact that we see it with glatiramer is not surprising. It's in the usual playbook in terms of what companies do to kind of continue on with their franchise. The other point I'll make is that the new formulation is a 3 times weekly medication versus a everyday injection for the 20 milligram Copaxone. And, you know, I think that does have definitely some patient adherence and patient kind of preference advantages relative to the everyday. So to the extent that in how active they were in converting patients and talking to neurologists and getting certain individuals switch for that reason versus other reasons is unclear, but we definitely observed a major shift in the year or so leading up to the release of this generic version in 2015.
Were there any other trends you noticed when you looked at this data over this time span? I know, for example, one that you mentioned in the paper was the shift to oral disease-modifying therapies from injectables. Did you notice anything else?
Yeah, I think the major trend that we saw was, as you just stated, is that there was a pretty dramatic shift away from the injectable therapies such as the interferons and glatiramer to some of the orals. In particular, Tecfidera essentially became the single, I guess, market leader by the end of 2017, which was the end of our study period. With that being said, all in all, if you consider all the different Copaxone or glatiramer products, so the 20 and 40 milligrams of the branded, and then I didn't mention thus far that in 2017, Mylan actually released a 20 and 40 milligram version of generic glatiramer as well, which shifted market share a little bit more at the end of 2017. So the point is, all in all, glatiramer still had kind of the plurality of all utilization at the end of the study period, but the single highest used drug was Tecfidera dimethyl fumarate at the end of the study period.
One last question I'll ask, Dan, is for those of us who have been keeping up with drug prices and particularly MS drug prices, I think we can all envision in our mind's eye the graph where plotted against time, we see the prices have just exploded in the last couple of years. And my question, is there any reason to believe that in the next couple of years that the trajectory of these prices is going to change?
You know, there's definitely more awareness, especially on the part of the public and clinicians and manufacturers about this issue, to the point where just in the last 3 or 4 months, Biogen released a new DMT called Vumerity, which is a slight modification of dimethyl fumarate. And so it's almost as if Biogen is anticipating the eventual loss of market exclusivity for Tecfidera. But they released Vumerity and in their press release mentioned how it was the lowest cost oral DMT or lowest priced oral DMT, which in fact is true, but it was only $500 less than the next most expensive product, which was $88,000 a year was the wholesale acquisition price or cost. Wow. So I think that there is an awareness that the public policymakers are watching this closely. But the decisions that are made and kind of what's been going on in terms of launch prices and continued escalation in prices, it seems like there haven't been substantive changes that have kind of moderated the growth over time in terms of pricing trend.
Well, we appreciate you studying this and keeping us apprised of changes and helping us understand these costs and where they're coming from. So thanks again for joining us to talk about this week. Once again, I've been speaking with Dan Hartung from Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, discussing his paper published in this week's issue of Neurology. And again, the title of the paper is Effect of Generic Glatiramer Acetate on Spending and Use of Drugs for Multiple Sclerosis. Dan, thanks again.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and I'm really excited to have Brian Callahan back on the podcast today. Brian is an associate professor of neurology at the University of Michigan, and he joined us back on the May 27th, 2019 podcast to talk with us about just how much our patients' out-of-pocket costs are rising And he's back with us today to talk about how these out-of-pocket costs are affecting our patients' ability to afford and adhere to their medications. Brian and his colleague's paper is published in this week's issue of Neurology. It's titled Association of Out-of-Pocket Cost on Adherence to Common Neurologic Medications. Brian, thanks for coming back on the podcast with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we jump into this current paper, it obviously builds very nicely on the last paper you discussed with us about rising out-of-pocket costs. Would you mind taking just a minute and set the stage for us by reviewing some of the main findings from that paper?
Yeah, happy to. Essentially, the last paper, we looked at out-of-pocket costs and found that they were rising quite dramatically, particularly within the last 10 years. So before 10 years ago, we didn't really have to consider out-of-pocket costs, but nowadays they keep getting higher and higher. And that's really a combination of the drug costs going up and the amount that patients are asked to participate with those costs have gone up as well. So that set the stage for this paper where we tried to look at what's the downstream effects of that.
Yeah, so it stands to reason that those high out-of-pocket costs would impact patients' ability to purchase and take the medicines. And so in this study, what drugs did you look at and what did you find when you studied how higher out-of-pocket costs affect patients' adherence?
Yeah, we looked at four different medication scenarios. We looked at neuropathy patients, either taking gabapentinoids or taking SNRIs. We looked at Parkinson's patients taking dopamine agonists. And we looked at dementia patients taking cholinesterase inhibitors. And the reason we did those particular comparisons is because each of them has a medicine that is cheap, but has very similar effect and side effects as another medicine for that same condition. And because of that, we were able to compare really precisely how much the out-of-pocket costs are affecting medication adherence.
So what did you find when you looked at these different patient populations in terms of their adherence when they faced higher out-of-pocket costs?
Yeah, well, we found a very predictable effect of higher out-of-pocket costs leading to lower medication adherence. So there's about a 5 to 10% drop in medication adherence for every $50 of out-of-pocket expense per month that a patient pays for medicines.
It's interesting. Were there any subpopulations or groups that were more susceptible to this effect?
So not necessarily susceptible to the out-of-pocket costs. We did find that minority populations, Blacks, Hispanics, and Asian populations all have lower medication adherence, even if you adjust for the out-of-pocket costs. And so this is consistent with other people's work as well. And so I think we always have to keep in mind that these populations, we need to figure out why they're not taking their medicines as much as others and try to knock down some of those barriers.
I think this is something that is very clinically relevant for all of us because, as you mentioned, neuropathy, Parkinson's disease, and dementia, all three of those are something that neurologists are going to face pretty routinely. And so I think it's something we should all be thinking of. I think it's important for us to consider and talk with patients about a drug's risk for, as we often say, financial toxicity when we're deciding what to prescribe. You discussed that one possible solution for this problem might be clinical decision support tools like we often see in our electronic medical records that could potentially help us assess that risk and have that information at the point of prescription. I'll say personally that I've used three different electronic medical records in the last several years, and each one had a tool that would show me the tier of the medicine in the patient's insurance plan, but not necessarily what the patient would actually have to pay at the drugstore, which would be much more helpful to me. Do you see these decision support tools as becoming more integral for us when we write prescriptions?
Well, I sure hope so. I think you point out that, you know, the technology exists. We can tell you how much medicines are going to cost, but we really need to get into very specific information. We should be able to tell with knowing the patient's pharmacy, their insurance plan, and the medicine, we should be able to tell you precisely how much a patient's going to have to pay per month in real time. But right now, those clinical decision support tools don't exist. You know, and they require all that information to kind of work together. So it does require coordination amongst those different groups, the insurance company, the healthcare system, the pharmacy, and getting the patient-specific information.
Yeah, so maybe one day those might be a remedy to this problem. But as things stand currently, do you have any thoughts about what we can be doing now as clinicians to help mitigate our patients' risk of not being able to adhere to the prescription because of costs? Is there anything we should be doing now?
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that this paper spurs both patients and physicians to have these conversations more often. I think a lot of times patients and physicians try to keep cost out of the doctor's visit, but that might have been okay 10 years ago when it came to medicines, but it's not really feasible now because it really is affecting how patients take their medicine. And this problem is only likely to get worse as drug costs go up and cost shifting to patients goes up. So we need to think about it and help patients navigate the system, find the medicine that's very similar that has lower cost, and realize that sometimes it's unpredictable. One medicine might be cheap for one patient and very expensive for the next. And so unless we have that back and forth conversation, we're not going to know that.
Terrific, Brian. That is helpful information. Is there anything else that we should be thinking of?
One more thing that I would point out is that, you know, there is the implications for combination pills and extended release formulations. I think sometimes physicians think about these as ways to increase patients' medication adherence, but they often have much higher price tags. So if they lead to higher out-of-pocket costs, they actually might be doing the opposite, decreasing medication adherence more than increasing it. So we should really keep that in mind when we think about combination pills and extended release formulations.
Yeah, that's a great reminder for us. I really encourage our audience to check out your paper again. It's titled Association of Out-of-Pocket Cost on Adherence to Common Neurologic Medications. It's coming out this week in the Neurology Journal. And once again, this is Jason Crobin speaking with Brian Callahan from the University of Michigan. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article on language and spatial dysfunction in Alzheimer's disease with white matter thorn-shaped astrocytes, and another article on detection of subtle gait disturbance and future fall risk in early multiple sclerosis. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. And now a personal note. This is my final podcast because my editorial tenure is ending. It's been amazing to see the enormous growth in content and distribution of this digital publication, and it's been a rare privilege to see the podcast teams at work. They've produced consistently fine material for our listeners with a laudable, overarching vision and dedication to quality. They've allowed me to be part of this effort, recording the intros and outros, and that's brought a sort of very minor celebrity. It's happened more than once that upon meeting someone, I'm greeted personally with the comment, "You really do sound like you." They feel part of our family as they've been listening long term, which is so gratifying. But all good things must come to an end. And so I'm signing off. This is Bob Gross, and you've been listening to the Neurology Podcast. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
Just a quick reminder, for a clearinghouse of neurology-related information on the coronavirus, go to the main page of the American Academy of Neurology and click on the coronavirus link to stay up to date. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.